Our first reading this morning comes from the Atlantic Monthly, the November issue, and this is a letter to the editor that was written in a response to an article called How America Lost Its Mind. And the author of this letter is a professor of anthropology in Wyoming, Robert L. Kelly. Kurt Anderson documents well how America has lost its mind, but only partly why. We live in a country whose history, economy, and culture have brought together people of many different races, ethnicities, and religions. But diversity, one of our nation's strengths, also creates tension. Culture is what allows us to make sense of the world. Travelers who experience culture shock know how disoriented it is when people say or do things that are not immediately intelligible, that don't seem normal. So when Somali Muslims move in down the street, their neighbors may feel uncomfortable. The difference in their physical appearance, their language, clothing, or music makes some residents feel like they don't know what's going on. And that is disconcerting. It leads them to retreat, to insist that the world is the way they say it is, no matter how many facts must say otherwise. Some point the finger at an easy target and want the source of their consternation to simply disappear. But that is the most magical of magical thinking, and this is why America has lost its mind. I agree with Anderson that this story could have a happy ending. We need to become world citizens, and such a trend is already underway. Economics and immigration move people around the globe at a rate that history has never before witnessed. Social media have their downside, but they also put the entire world in the palm of your hand. Diversity is becoming the new normal. Although adults today may look at askance at those Somali neighbors, their children will not wonder about their language or clothing or religion, only whether they listen to Beyonce or play soccer. The recent sad display of white supremacy in Charlottesville, Virginia, is perhaps evidence of the death throes of an old order.
Our second reading is called The Cologne Concert, and it's from the podcast Hidden Brains. January 27th, 1975 was the most exciting day yet of 17-year-old Vera Branda's life. She stepped out onto the vast stage of the Cologne Opera House in Germany. The auditorium was empty, lit only by the emergency exit signs. But in a few hours, the American pianist Keith Jarrett was going to play. She, the youngest concert promoter in Germany, had convinced the Opera House to host a late night concert, and it had sold out in just a few hours. 1,400 people would fill the auditorium to listen to Jarrett play a completely improvised, unrehearsed concert. When Jarrett and his producer arrived at the concert hall, they glanced at the piano and were noticeably quiet. They played some notes. They glanced at each other and then turned to 17-year-old Vera and said, "If you don't get another piano, this concert isn't going to happen tonight." The piano was literally unplayable. The piano was out of tune, and the black keys were sticking. The pedals did not work. The upper register of the keyboard was harsh and tinny because the felt had worn away. It was weak in the bass register, and again, the pedals did not work. And most importantly, it was too small. So it didn't even have enough volume to actually reach the back of the Cologne auditorium. So of course, Jarrett refused to play. Apparently there had been some confusion by the opera house staff. Jarrett had requested a Busendorfer 290 Imperial Concert Grand Piano. The opera house staff found another Busendorfer piano backstage, a much smaller baby grand piano, and assuming it was the one requested, placed it on the stage. The staff did not realize that the piano they found was a small piano intended for rehearsals and was in very poor condition. Brandis tried everything to find a replacement. She even rounded up some friends to push a grand piano through the city streets, but it was raining hard, and the local piano tuner warned her that a piano would never survive such a trip. The piano tuner worked on fixing up the little piano that was on stage, but he couldn't improve it a whole lot. Keith Jarrett left, and he went out to his car, leaving 17-year-old Vera to greet 1,400 soon-to-be-furious concertgoers. Vera had no other choice but to beg Jarrett to perform. Through the window of his car, standing in the rain, Vera begged. Jarrett eventually took pity and said, "Never forget, only for you." A few hours later, Jarrett walked out onto that vast opera house stage to the small, unplayable piano in front of a packed concert hall and began. Jarrett and his producer decided to record the concert so they had documentation what a musical catastrophe sounds like, so they could play it to future promoters and tell them to be sure to be thorough and ensure there is a proper piano. But instead, what they recorded was absolutely beautiful. Jarrett completely avoided the harsh upper registers and stuck to the middle of the keyboard, which offered the music a soothing feel. Since he had to compensate for how quiet the piano was, he used these rolling, repetitive riffs in the bass to try to get some resonance, and during the concert, he stood up and pounded on the keys. At different parts of the recording, you can actually hear him moaning in frustration. All those adjustments Jarrett had to make to cope with that awful piano forced him into new realms of creativity. The Cologne Concert Album is the best-selling jazz album in history. The best solo jazz album in history. And the best piano album in history.
It is always a privilege to be able to share with you my ideas and thoughts. When I'm working on my sermons at home, I hold all of you in my hearts, and I imagine this moment where I'm standing here talking with you. I have to admit that preparing sermons is not without stress. Today in particular, I'm talking about some esoteric ideas, and I wanted to make sure that I was clear on my comments, so you'll be able to give me some feedback after the service today. But it's kind of reassuring to know that I'm not alone in my sermon preparation stress. The UU Ministers Facebook page, someone always posts on Saturday, "How's it going, sermonators?" And then there's however many posts of stressed out people or tips on procrastination is a common one that people post. But my favorite recent one was a minister who said, when you're out and about today doing whatever you're doing, could you look for the point of my sermon? Because I lost it somewhere earlier today. It's an easy thing to do. So I decided that I'm going to start out with the point of my sermon. And the point of my sermon is from that song that Michelle and Barbara sang so beautifully. We're better off for all that we let in. I might even take that a step forward. Everyone is better off for all that we let in. So let's get started on the esoteric part of things, the Higgs boson particle. And I have to apologize to any physicists out there in our audience today. So how many of you heard about the Higgs boson when they found it? Wow, big event, right? Huh, what's that about? So here's what I've learned about the Higgs boson particle. Physicists had this theory of how everything in the universe fit together. And it was a perfectly beautiful mathematical model, dancing and beautiful, like one of the authors described it as the perfect snowflake of interconnection. But the problem was that nothing in that model had any mass. So we were all of our electrons and atoms were dancing around, but we really didn't exist because we didn't have any mass. And when they tried to add mass to their equation, the equations got all screwed up. They got clunky. The symmetry and the beautiful patterns would disappear. So Higgs, after which the boson is named, had this big idea in the 1960s that the equations were perfectly fine, but perhaps all of the universe is swimming around in some field that helps create our mass. Or more specifically, a field where our interacting with the field and interacting with each other creates the mass. Now, of course, with any really, really brilliant idea, it was first rejected by the physics journals as having nothing to do with physics. But then, over the years, it caught on, and by the early 20th century, all physicists kind of assumed it was correct, but no one had ever proven it. So that's how the Hadron Collider, it's on the front of your order of service, built in Europe 17 miles of tunnels to accelerate particles, pretty much to prove that the Higgs boson particle existed. And on July 4th of 2012, I think, they announced that they'd found it. So they found the particle that allowed them to project that, extrapolate out the idea of this field that creates the possibility of mass. Kind of like an idea of fish swimming in an ocean, where the fish don't know the ocean exists, but the ocean is what sort of gives them mass, gives them something to resist against. Some folks call this particle the God particle, because it's the universe that we all swim in. It's the thing that gives power and presence to our interactions. Other scientists call it the goddamn particle, because it took $10 billion, 3,000 scientists, and 50 years to find it. So one physicist who really helped me through all this is Brian Greene. He wrote an article in Smithsonian Magazine. He talks about this field, if you think of it like molasses that exerts a drag force on particles, aka the things that we're made up of, when we move through the field, and it makes it harder for us to move around, and it creates our mass. Think of a ping pong ball, a light little thing, but when you push it in water, it becomes much heavier. The resistance of the water makes the ping pong heavier. Green also suggests that this idea of the field is nature and nature and nurture, in the sense of nature are the equations that everything makes sense, the symmetry and the patterns of nature, and the field, this Higgs field, is the environment, is the nurture in which we all swim. So when I heard Brian Green talking about the Higgs boson field and the particle on the podcast On Being, I immediately thought of a connection to process theology. So I know Roger has preached on process theology, Scott, when he was here, did, and I've used it in some of my sermons as well. But let me give you just a little background. The basic idea of process theology is that everything in the universe is part of an interconnected system. And in every moment, we are all becoming together. So we're all in the act of becoming each moment. And it's our interactions with each other where we co-create our world together. I do things that influence you in ways known and unknown. You do things that influence me in ways that are known and unknown. And we bring all of our lives to each moment and move forward into the next moment with all the information that comes into us. Co-creating is the word that I like to use for this idea of how we become in every moment. We're co-creating our lives, co-creating our future, and co-creating our world. Now, process theology has a very dynamic idea about God. The God in process theology is not a transcendent one who sits up in the heaven and knows everything that's going to happen and watches it all unfold. The God of process theology is an actor in this process of becomings. And God acts in two ways. God holds and connects us, kind of like a field. Holds and connect us, but God of process theology challenges and encourages us, but most importantly, doesn't control the outcome. This God of process theology is a player in the mix, but doesn't control the outcome. Makes me think of the interdependent web of all existence. Our seventh principle is Unitarian Universalists. And this idea of God in a panentheistic way, that God is the system itself, part of the system. God is the web. God is the field of the web, not an overlord. It's a lot. Process theology, interestingly enough, was started by a mathematician. This is a place where physics and religion meet in that esoteric out there space. So one of the questions in process theology of this God presence field actor is, what does this God want? What is the role? What is the goal of this God that's engaged with us, encouraging us, supporting us? And the process theologians answer that this God wants the greatest number of beings to have the most fulfillment, the most satisfaction. How does this God achieve it? How does our God of process theology achieve this? By persuasion. Sometimes God persuades us towards order, sometimes towards chaos. I preached a sermon, God is a Verb, in the spring, and several people felt like there weren't enough verbs in my God is a Verb sermon. So here we are, God as a Verb. God is urging, connecting, challenging, persuading. The wonderful lyricist Brian Wren has a, a song about God where he calls God the nudging discomforter, prodding and shaking, spinner of chaos, pulling and twisting, waking our lives to creative unease. And why? Why all this chaos and pulling and twisting? Because this is what will generate the greatest richness, the depth of life, that swamp and muck and juice that leads life to its greatest fulfillment, to lead each of us and our world to the greatest satisfaction and fulfillment. So contrast this idea to systems that are repetitive and closed. The one that came to me immediately was dog breeding, or breeding any kind of animal. If you keep breeding within the same population, you start having problems. You start limiting the health and the vitality of the... When I was growing up, I was given this idea of a heaven where everything would be wonderful all the time. I think of heaven in that way, and I thought that was a terrible idea, because I thought it would be incredibly boring. A completely closed system where nothing ever shifts or modifies. How many of you like to read books where nothing ever happens? Where everything is good all the time? This God of process theology wants us to take everything in that we can so that we can help our world be more deeply connected, so that each of us, each of our becomings, will achieve greater depth and fulfillment. We're better off for all that we let in. Okay, that's all really extract. Let's bring it right down to earth. Keith Jarrett. Ina played a portion of the transcription of that piece that he improvised at that concert with the terrible piano. And I think Ina had her moments of discomfort when I asked her to play that piece for us. He had only the middle of the keyboard, no pedals, no volume, and he stepped into that discomfort zone and triumphed. What do you think he took away from that experience? Probably he'll never play on a piano like that again. But I also think he might have taken away the realization that something amazing can come from strife, can come from discomfort. This month in our spiritual deepening circles, we're talking about fault lines. People are sharing those moments in their life where everything was upended and, you know, death of a loved one, big change in career, all those times where, whoa, the world shifted and tilted for you. And we're also sharing how those gave birth to some of our most significant growth and richness of our lives. Obstacles are what spur creativity, growth, resilience, compassion, and self-knowledge. So, as with our circle folks, life often presents us with challenges. But what about the idea of choosing to be in a place of discomfort? A place where you embrace the chaos and the challenge. Okay, I can already hear from some of you, I can already imagine what you're thinking. Really? I'm not uncomfortable enough in our world right now? You're asking me to be even more uncomfortable? I think for some folks, they are truly in discomfort. Those that are differently abled suffer from chronic pain, mental health challenges, poverty, family stress. These are all situations that leave us in a state of discomfort. I'm talking to those of us who are comfortable in the general sense. I really like my easy chair at home. It's positioned just right so I can throw the ball for the dog right down the hallway. It's got the TV there. I got a place to put my cup of coffee. But I don't want to stay in that easy chair all day and every day. Many of us are probably listening to the same music that we listened to 20 years ago. In these times of disturbance, chaos, distrust, pain, many of us are just trying to control as much as we can and trying to minimize the disruption in our lives. Roger and I were at a retreat last month, and we learned about these ideas of zones of comfort. The center is the comfort zone. That's my easy chair. Everything is just the way you want it to be. And then there's a ring of the discomfort zone. That's where, yikes, I don't like this. This is where you want to retreat right back into that comfort zone. And then on the outer ring is the alarm zone. I think many of us have been in the alarm zone in the past year or in our lives where you can't handle it and you need to take care of yourself. You need to retreat. Can we learn to spend a little bit more time in this discomfort zone? Can we learn perhaps to let ourselves be transformed by the discomfort zone? We're starting our next class of Beloved Conversations. That's our anti-racist program that this will be our third year. We'll have 10 folks participating in that. And they will spend 10 sessions in their discomfort zone. Because talking about issues of racism and bias is very uncomfortable. And they're willingly doing this because of the growth they know they will experience and because of what they're going to be able to offer our world after they've been through that. Our reading about diversity, it's easy, the reading that I had from the Atlantic Monthly, it's easy for us liberals, to white liberals, let me add, to feel like there's other people out there that have a problem with diversity. It's those people in the Midwest who don't like Muslims who create all these terrible stories about them, who don't take the time to really understand them. It's easy to project that problem onto those people. But don't we all have a little piece of that? Don't we all have our own version of that? Discomfort with people that aren't like you or circumstances that you don't understand. We want things our way. So it's been 1 year from the election, 1 year before I stood up here and spilled my guts out to you about what was going on in the world. And there's been plenty of discomfort in that time. I think many of us have managed discomfort. I've said consistently three things in the past year that we need to do. The first one is take care of ourselves. When you feel like you're in that alarm zone, to take some time in that comfort zone with whatever works for you. I've said the second thing you need to do is do something political. Don't be passive. And the third thing that you need to do is reach out and support vulnerable populations. And we've certainly done a lot of that good work. But I'm asking you now to really manage to step more consistently into that discomfort zone, because I don't think we have a choice. I don't think we have a choice. This is not the time. Those of us who have the ability and the capacity, it is not the time to retreat to our comfort zone and let the chaos do its thing. Here's one technique you can use to manage the discomfort zone, and that is curiosity. Ask the questions, explore, think that allow you to sustain discomfort while you're reflecting on what you can learn and grow from this experience. For every time you judge someone else for being closed-minded, take the opportunity to put yourself in a situation that's uncomfortable for you. Enter with curiosity. Try new foods, new music. Meet your neighbors. Greet someone who is different from you. Read the news from the opposite perspective and bring your curiosity. We need to practice stepping out of and staying in our discomfort zone. Practice not retreating when it gets hard. This is how we build resilience, and this is how we save our country. So I want you to know in all this, every time I stand up here and say these things to you, that you are not alone. You are part of this congregation. You are part of the interdependent web of all existence. You are part of this universe, held together by a life force that challenges you and sustains you. We are all swimming in the same Higgs field. We are co-creating our lives and our world together. And may what we create be rich and challenging and fulfilling. So may it be.